If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. For Britain, the winter of 1962 and 63 was the worst in living memory. The Solent froze, icebergs stalked the Irish Sea, and the nation ground to a frozen halt. But as Juliet Nicholson chronicles in her new book, Frostquake, as Britain shivered under a blanket of snow and ice, new cultural and political forces were beginning to challenge the status quo, as the Beatles, David Bailey, and Mary Quant began to shake things up. Here, in conversation with our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, Juliet reveals how those few frozen months at the start of the 60s changed modern Britain for good.
Juliet, your new book, Frostquake, tells a story of the great freeze that paralysed Britain over the winter of 1962 and 63. And it also chronicles how the country emerged that spring and summer, a different country. Now, before examining all that in more detail, I wonder if you could paint a picture of how bad the winter of 1962/63 was. How unprecedented was this weather?
There had obviously been lots of snowy winters in people's memories before they arrived at 1962. There was a particularly ferocious one in 1947, which I think made an enormous impact, particularly because it was only a couple of years after the ending of the Second World War, and deprivation and misery were still there, and the weather on top of it, extremely cold and snowy winter. But the weather, the winter of 1962 was worse, partly because it was colder and partly because it never stopped. So what happened was there had been really the final of these London smogs in the December of 62, during which thousands of people lost their lives through inhaling this terrible polluted air, really came about through the coal fires that were burning in cities. And to see people walking around the London streets in December 62 in masks was not an unusual thing. But on Boxing Day 1962, the snow began to fall, and it was a storm that came over from Europe, from Russia, from Siberia itself, and began to fall that day and did not stop falling until the sort of first 10 days of March. And the effect was enormous on the land. There were icebergs in the River Mersey in Liverpool. There were icebergs down south in the Solent. The sea itself froze for a good mile out. You could walk on waves all the way through. And the wind chill factor was the equivalent to the loss of 80% of body heat, at which stage flesh freezes. So it was quite some winter.
So can you paint a picture of what it was like to live through that for 3 months? I mean, how much misery did this weather event inflict upon Britons?
Well, obviously, snow and ice immediately put a stop to the infrastructure of travel. So roads were impassable. Airplanes, airports were closed. Gatwick was completely iced over and impossible to use. Trains couldn't run on their tracks. And of course, this meant that delivery lorries couldn't reach the shops. There was shelves in the shops were empty. If you were old, it was very, very difficult to get out in these terrible conditions, even if there was anything to buy. Meals on Wheels did their very best, but they couldn't get round everybody. People died in drifts in their cars. And to compound it, there was a trade union strike of the electrical union. And so the national grid faltered or was interrupted by this strike for pay rise. And so it's hard to emphasize quite how paralyzing this weather was, but it was national and ubiquitous and lengthy, weeks and weeks and weeks of this deprivation.
And as you outline in the book, this is something that had a significant impact on animals as well as humans, wasn't it? I mean, I wonder if you could just describe the impact on wildlife of this weather.
Absolutely. Well, if you were a hedgehog or a squirrel, you knew what to do. You went underground with enough lunch and supper for a few months. But above ground, there were sights, terrifying sights of seagulls caught, frozen within a wave. Birds were caught in freezing gusts of wind and plummeted to their death right there, stone dead. Sheep were turning cannibalistic. New Forest ponies were feral. People were told to be careful if they were out with a shopping bag with food in case they'd be attacked by one of these ponies. Kestrels were seen on domestic bird tables, desperate for food. So it was not good to be either human or animal during such conditions, unless you were a child, of course, when you were constantly sledding, snowballing, and even skiing. So it was not that the beauty of the snow, which began to pool, I think, for adults, was terrific for kids, especially if it meant not going to school.
I was going to say, it must have been a 3 month snowball fight for some of them. You must have really enjoyed that.
It was. I was one of those. I was eight, And we built some amazing structures out of snow when I was little. But I think my parents weren't enjoying it quite so much as I was. And
you write in the book that for many older people, the terrible weather signalled the ending of a way of life, the loss of familiarity, of certainty, of the old way of life. I mean, I guess this speaks to one of the main themes of your book, that Britain in the early 60s was a nation in transition, like well on the cusp of a great social and, I guess, political change. I mean, what were the older generations scared of losing in the early 60s?
I mean, that's such a good question. I think that it wasn't so much the fear of change exactly, but really that so many of that generation, people had been born and remembered both world wars and indeed the Spanish flu, had already been through so much convulsive change. Their lives had changed so dramatically over the century between, you know, 1914 up to the mid-1950s, 1945, if you like, towards the end, at the end of the Second World War, that the prospect of a further convulsion was just not what they wanted. I mean, there was a new television program at the time, which was called Coronation Street, in which there was an old battle axe called Ina Sharples. And she represented that particular generation in which the monarchy was on a pedestal, the church was on a pedestal, and the politicians did the right thing. You know, Winston Churchill saw us through. The sort of conservatism, the Conservative Party had been in power for 12 years by 1962. Harold Macmillan was the Prime Minister at that time. And conservatism with a small c was the name of the game amongst so much of that particular generation. I think that the Wolfenden report that was looking into the legalization of homosexuality used code names for when they were talking about homosexuality or indeed prostitutes. So they would say, shall we address the Huntley and Palmer situation in order to protect the dignity or not to offend women present?
So they're quite euphemistic, basically.
Completely. Sort of euphemistic. So it was a sort of, they wore hats. They did what was called uncovered, which was when they would take their hats off, they would doff their hats when somebody of some sort of establishment figure might pass by or walk into a room. The deference combined with, as I say, this dread of yet another revolution. And, I mean, maybe we'll talk a little bit later on about the prospect of a Third World War, but it was ever present. And so I think it was just, let's stay still, stay as we are. Don't rock the boat. We've had enough. Don't bring your campaign for nuclear disarmament or whatever into our lives.
Okay, so to kind of turn that on its head, I mean, throughout the book, you paint a metaphorical picture of forces forming beneath the ice, waiting to be unleashed with the coming of spring. I mean, why were these forces unleashed in the early 60s as opposed to, say, the early 50s or the early 70s? I mean, why was there such a pent-up frustration with the status quo among the younger population?
I think, I'm not so sure it was the pent-upness. I think it was a sort of growing consciousness in a generation who had not fought in a war, who were born around the end of the Second World War, the generation who were looking to live a life different to their own, to that their parents had. They were richer. They had the contraceptive pill, which had just come, albeit in limited quantity, but it was available from 1961, I think, onwards. They wanted to do things differently. They were looking for, they needed a sort of way out of repeating what had gone before them. And this sort of sense of desire for change was exacerbated, I think, by the way the Tory party looked. They wore the same clothes as their grandparents. They shot grouse for fun. So this youthful awareness that they could do something differently, we can do something differently, evolved, I think, out of the coming of age of that particular generation.
Do you think that the bad weather in any way accelerated these changes, or did it merely crystallise this image of stasis followed by rapid change?
I think that the experience of being locked down did certainly present an opportunity for both contemplation about the way things might change, but also the opportunity to work out how things might change. I think that there was time to think, but there was also this business of not being able to leave your house. So the television, the increasing power of television, as well as other media, was enormously powerful in feeding new thought, new ideas. In particular, a programme called Thank That Was the Week That Was, which was a satirical programme known as TW3, went out every Saturday night, had 12 million viewers because the pubs weren't accessible, concert halls were difficult to get to, movies, cinemas were closed because of the cold. And there was another programme on at the same time, also on Saturday night, called Thank Your Lucky Stars, which showcased old pop bands, music bands, but also new ones. And so this opportunity stuck in front of a television set, which was an increasingly popular thing to have, had an intensely dramatic effect on the way people thought. This programme, TW3, which was run by young people, David Frost was the presenter. He was 21 or 22, and they were the satirists who bashed all these establishment ways of doing things. Nobody was not fair game, even the Queen, perhaps especially the Queen, but actually especially the politicians.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And to me, that moment is absolutely fundamental as to the way the establishment would still resist the change that was completely essential if we were to move forward and away from this complacent, dishonest way of behaving towards the British public.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Now, you just mentioned the fateful word lockdown there. Did you write this book during the lockdown we experienced at the beginning of 2020? And if so, how did that feel? Did you see many parallels between the period you were describing and what you were going through at the time?
I didn't set out to write a book that had parallels with the lockdown. Gosh, I mean, that would have been a dreadful foresight had I had it. But I did finish the book in the first lockdown, and the paralysis on the country imposed this time by a virus rather than the weather was, to say the least, uncanny. As I was writing it, and we moved from winter into spring last year in 2020, the way that the natural world was responding to this lockdown struck me as something to hold on to. It gave me optimism. The skies were very clear. There were no aeroplanes above us. I read that the water in the canals in Venice had suddenly revealed all the fish that nobody had seen. And so this sense of renewal and of optimism, and that we might emerge from something different and even, may I hope, better, was very pertinent to me as I was writing those last chapters. What, of course, I did not know is that the virus would, in our time now, this virus would continue to be something that remains such a massive challenge that even as I'm talking to you right now, we don't quite know when we are going to emerge from it. But emerge from it we will, as we did from a snowy winter, as we did from the Spanish flu in 100 years ago, as we did from two world wars. We will emerge, and thought and some sort of enforced pause will, I firmly believe, have had some effect to the positive on the way we go forward.
I'm glad I asked you that question, actually, because that's made me feel a bit more optimistic.
Good.
I think we all need it. Okay. So,
we need it, but we need to believe it too.
That's true. That's very true,
I think.
So, Julia, if you could pick three figures that personify the transformation that was affected in the spring and summer of 1963, who would they be?
I'd have to pick the Beatles, because they brought that optimism and joy right slam bang into our consciousnesses. They changed the way that we thought about not just music, this joyous, wonderful, please, please me, she loves you, this intense positivity, but their sense that they did no longer had to conform to the conventions of the way stars were supposed to present themselves. They had longer hair. They joshed around with each other. They wrote about things that we thought about, we knew about. They were not cliches. They were absolute breaths of fresh air. They were unknown at the beginning of the winter, except for in their local area, really. And they toured the country during that winter in a these terrifying conditions, just up and down the Pennines in their battered old van with all their kit, all their stuff tumbling all over them as they negotiated the Pennine Way. But emerged at the top of the hit parade on the first day that there was no frost. And the symbolism of that great kind of wow burst of wowness and music and happiness and energy and youthfulness is impossible to ignore. I would choose Harry Evans. Harold Evans was the editor of the Northern Echo, and he became one of the most famous journalists of the century, became the editor of the London Sunday Times. But at that time, he was the editor of the Northern Echo, and his intention to make things better, very specifically highlighting the case of pollution, of the way women were treated, of the way homosexuality was dealt with, became campaigns, lifelong campaigns for this man who was in his 30s at the beginning in 1962, and who sadly died last year, but still absolutely there to fight for the underdog, as did the third person I might choose for that particular time, for the 60s, would be a barrister called Jeremy Hutchinson, who would take on anybody, even if it meant foregoing his fee, which he often did, whether it was Vassal, a homosexual man in the Foreign Office accused of telling secrets to the Russians, or whether it was the great train robbers who he defended, or indeed later on Christine Keeler. He was there. He was a posh man, educated in a public school, but whose sense of getting it right, just as Harry Evans did, was paramount throughout their careers. And they're total heroes, as are all the Beatles.
Great. How did the establishment react to this movement of the tectonic plates?
We haven't really talked very much about the Profumo crisis. It was at the very heart of this winter. And the fact that the Minister for War, John Profumo, lied to the House of Commons was the way in which the politicians were, and his lie was exposed, were never really quite allowed to get away with this old boy behaviour again. I think that when Profumo came into the House of Commons at the end of March and said that he had not had a relationship with Christine Keeler, a model who was also accused of sleeping with a Russian spy and passing on the state secrets of the government. When Profumo said that he had not done these things, when he had done these things, as he sat down in his seat in the House of Commons, Harold Macmillan, the Prime Minister, moved towards him and patted him on the back as if to say, well done. And to me, that moment is absolutely fundamental as to the way the establishment would still resist the change that was completely essential if we were to move forward and away from this complacent, dishonest way of behaving towards the British public.
So they wanted it to be a case of business as usual.
Business as usual. Let's protect one of our own. Let's condone the lie. It's absolutely outrageous. And by the summer of 1963, John Profumo could no longer continue to lie and had to return to the House of Commons and resign. I think it is, I would argue that it's difficult to say that the world changed during that winter. But what happened was light was shone on these situations, whether it was race or whether it was politics or some sort of institutional iniquities. Light was shone on them, and the thing of getting away with it was no longer feasible. It began to melt. There was a sort of melting. So as the snow began to melt, so it exposed these practices, these ways of life that had been entrained for so many hundreds of years, began to shift.
Now, the American poet Sylvia Plath is quite prominent within the pages of your book. And how did the tragedy of her final months sort of represent Britain in the early 60s?
Sylvia Plath was 30 years old. She was a very little known poet at the time. She had had her poetry published. She'd had her latest poems were regularly in the Observer newspaper, but she was not as famous as her husband, Ted Hughes, who had just left her. Sylvia Plath was had already attempted suicide once 10 years earlier. She was fragile, mentally fragile. When I was reading those last few months of hers, when she had been left by Ted Hughes, had moved into a house in London with her two tiny children and had to cope on her own, try to look after her two children without the network of her family who were over in America or her husband who was off with another woman, it toppled her. At the same time as it toppled her, it incited in her a creativity that was utterly miraculous. And the beauty of those poems that she wrote in those last few weeks of her life are poignancy such as one will rarely come across, because you know they are cries, sometimes screams for help. And I think that now, when people are alone in these circumstances, unable to see the people that they love, unable to reach out, unable to be hugged, the mental stress of this is so, so understandable and so disturbing. And for Sylvia Plath, it ended in the worst possible circumstances in February on the 11th when she took her life.
Now, you also mentioned what you call the pacey, modern, convenient world across the Atlantic, i.e. in America. What impact did that nation have on young Britain's thirst for change in the early 60s? I mean, was it a sense that they were looking across the Atlantic and thinking, right, we want a bit of that, as it were?
Everything in America was bigger, brighter, more sexy than anything that we had over here in sort of grey post-war England. They had cars, they had washing machines, they had blue jeans. They had a president of the United States who was young, glamorous, went sailing, had a sort of tan about him, had a sort of sexy wife. And above all, they had music. They had Elvis. And this sense of this kind of neon, zingy place across the sea, especially, I think, if you were in Liverpool, where the cruise ships and the supply ships and the cargo ships were constantly going across the Atlantic between the two cities of New York and Liverpool, this sense of what they had over there was just so enviable, so desirable. Of course, the wonderful, amazing thing was that a year later, by 1964, this musical emphasis had totally flipped over, and it was us with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, who were also in their infancy in the winter of 1963. And I write quite a lot about them. Suddenly they were the dominant ones, and we were the people who America was looking to be setting the pace. And so there was this really rapid role reversal, as it were. But yes, America America, the newfound land, the absolute sort of promised place to get to.
And speaking of events on the other side of the Atlantic, the Great Freeze of 62-63 took place quite soon, didn't it, after the Cuban Missile Crisis. How much did, as you've mentioned before, fear of a Third World War cast a shadow over Britain's psyche in this period?
Yes, you're right, Spencer. The Cuban Missile Crisis had taken place in October. Kennedy had been told that if the Russians were to detonate a nuclear bomb, a third of humanity would be wiped out. And that included Europe. And so he diffused the situation and was to add to the significance of the power of America and of Kennedy himself in the public eye. The prospect of following a third Hiroshima and Nagasaki, yet another, a third world war, was very much, I mean, my parents talked about it often. They talked about it in whispers, but we knew about it. There was an air raid shelter, a defunct air raid shelter in the garden where I grew up. And my brother and I, my younger brother and I, had our stuff in there. For just in case, you know, I had a comb and an apple and he had his dinky toys. He was five. But we put our precious things down there just in case. Even I was aware of that prospect of this atom bomb. And spies, you know, spies were everywhere. Philby disappeared in the January of 1963. The movie of the first James Bond movie came out that winter, Dr. No. Spies were both glamorous and very real, very present. They were in our lives, and a Third World War was a very real terror.
So it sounds like your recollections of this period are quite vivid. I mean, how much did they influence your writing of this book? How much was this period in your mind as you were committing the words to the page?
Funny thing about memory is that when you allow yourself to look at photographs or even have conversations with my brother or whatever, stuff comes back. It's a kind of marvellous thing about getting older. It returns. And I was amazed at how much I remembered in very, very vivid detail of that winter. It was an extraordinary winter for anybody living through it, really, because of the cold. For me, it was made particularly sad because my grandfather's wife, my grandmother, had recently died and he was mourning her. But I think also he was one of those who was mourning an old way of life. So I remember that. But I also remember listening to that music for the first time. And the thrill of listening to those four long-haired guys from Liverpool was just something that was I'd never come across before. I'm not sure I've ever quite felt that thrill again. It felt like anything was possible. If you've got that music and that sort of excitement of being mucking about in the snow, that was childhood of sort of wondrousness. I think I learned about music then. I learned about compassion in terms of looking after my grieving grandfather. And I began to read properly that winter. So I learned about books, and all those three things still matter.
That was Juliet Nicholson. Her book, Frostquake, The Frozen Winter of 1962 and How Britain Emerged a Different Country, is out now, published by Chatto and Windus. Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back tomorrow when Max Adams will be speaking about Britain after the fall of Rome.